The person I asked had no idea that the company was trying to commercialize this. And so he said, yes, it was fine to publish it. Whereas had he known, he would have said, no, don't publish this. And I would never have been allowed to tell the story, ever. But he didn't know. And so it was exceptionally lucky on my part. This is a lovely example of a piece of science that's sort of driven international law. And I think it's a real privilege to have been part of that and be part of that story.
Series 2, we've looked at many different issues that people and society face day to day. This episode looks at solving a problem on an industrial scale using science. Scientific discovery is all around us. It's happening right now. Over the last decade, we have seen some astounding discoveries. The reprogramming of stem cells, the largest black hole ever discovered, and gravitational waves that Albert Einstein first predicted. It was about 2 years ago when I first met Professor Graham Hutchings. He was lecturing my class in catalysis. I was so inspired by the story he told in his lecture series, one of discovery and serendipity, so I'm thrilled he's agreed to share it on Think Tank. This is Professor Graham Hutchings' story.
Okay, I'm Graham Hutchings. I'm Regius Professor of Chemistry at Cardiff University, and I'm a chemist. And I wanted to be a chemist ever since I was 11 years old. I'm obviously quite old now, so when I was 11, that's a long time ago. And school didn't do science as much as it does now, especially at primary school. There was no science that I recognised as science when I was at school up until the age of 11. But then I went to Weymouth Grammar School, and we were exposed to science for the first time. And the first experiment I saw demonstrated was the distillation of water. Very simple. Of course, distillation is an incredibly important aspect of most people's lives. If you drink strong alcohol, distillation is required for that. But I was 11-year-old. I wasn't thinking about that. I watched the teacher distill this purple liquid from one flask, and came a colourless liquid in the other, and I was mesmerised. I thought, this is fantastic. I want to be a chemist, because it was a chemistry lesson. I wanted the chemistry set. So I went home and told my parents I wanted the chemistry set. And they said, well, you've got to save up all your money. So I did for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I finally got a chemistry set. In those days, chemistry sets were actually pretty good, I have to say, compared to what they are now. And I set up exactly the same experiment, but on a much smaller scale. But my apparatus wobbled, and the teachers didn't. And I thought, that's not right. And so I put a cork into the receiving vessel, and then it didn't wobble. And I thought, that's fantastic. So I started the experiment, and the water started to boil, and then it stopped boiling, and then it started to boil again, and it stopped boiling. And I realized what I'd done just before the explosion, and I'd created a closed system by putting the cork in. But that was even better than the teacher's experiment, because I had an explosion, blew up. I wasn't injured in any way, but I thought, this is incredible. This is what I really want to be. So that was 11, and then after that, I devoured chemistry books and really got into it, and knew that that was what I wanted to do. Now, many people, when they thinking about how they're going to do their careers, don't have that sort of kickstart. I appreciate that. But there has to be something that sort of inspires you at some point to do whatever career you want to do. So in my case, it was very early. I then went through university, got a chemistry degree at University College London, did a PhD there in biological chemistry. And then I got a job in industry. Basically, I had a young family and we needed the money. And I got a job with Imperial Chemical Industries, which was a huge company back in 1975 when I joined it. And I did research. I then moved into production, where I was in charge of production of plasticizer alcohols at the end of my stint on oil works in Billingham. And that was a fantastic experience, where you really are making, you know, thousands of tons of chemicals and in charge of a very large workforce. Following that, I wanted to go back to research. But this was the early 1980s now, and Britain was in recession. And consequently, there weren't any jobs in research. And in the end, I was sent to South Africa in 1981 on secondment from ICI to a company called African Explosives and Chemical Industries, which basically made chemicals in South Africa. And that was a major turning point, I would say. Now, I won't discuss the politics of the situation, as everybody knows. Apartheid was abhorrent, and it was an interesting experience for us living under apartheid years, espousing the opposite views to the current state at that point. But the industry job was really good, and I was asked to come up with a much better catalyst for a process that they were operating. And this is a very simple process. This is the hydrochlorination of acetylene. And basically, it's a way of making vinyl chloride, and that is when polymerase becomes polyvinyl chloride, PVC. I think most people know what PVC is. It's a well-known polymer. In fact, it's the third most manufactured polymer in the world, and it's manufactured probably about 30 million tons a year of this. And it's a non-biodegradable plastic. And, of course, you need non-biodegradable plastics for certain applications, you know, in buildings and in insulation of electrical cables, things like this. If you don't have non-biodegradable materials, they just won't work. And I was asked to work on this because the current catalyst for that process was mercuric chloride on carbon. And mercury is an insidious poison. And the catalyst was... it was absolutely awful. It was comprised about 10% of the mass as mercuric chloride. And the process operates at about 200 degrees. And mercuric chloride sublimes into the gas phase at 180 degrees. So the mercuric chloride didn't stay in the reactor very long. Enormous amounts of mercury going into the environment anywhere near these production units. And in China, there's 13 million tons vinyl chloride being made using this process, and every year about 1,000 tons of mercury is lost to the environment. Now, that might not sound a very large figure, but you only need a few ppm to cause very nasty problems.
PPM stands for parts per million. It's a term used in chemistry to denote a very, very low concentration. 1/1000th of a gram dissolved in a litre of water is 1 ppm of mercury in this case.
It's an insidious poison. It's a teratogen. It causes birth defects if mothers have exposed to mercury during their pregnancy. And this led to something called the Minamata disease from a village in Minamata in Japan, where methyl mercury was being discharged, and this was being concentrated in fish, which was the diet of the local people, and they consequently were exposed to massive mercury poisoning. And as a result of that, the world has wanted to remove mercury from all its applications. The Minamata Convention seeks to remove mercury from the environment. And so this process started to become the major use of mercury in the world. 60% of the mercury that's mined every year goes into making the catalyst that's used in that process. So it's obvious that you can't continue to use mercury in that way. But this work I was talking about goes back to 1982 when I was asked to come up with a better catalyst. And there is a saying that we have, that a day in the library saves 6 months in the laboratory. And that means you should always read the previous papers and the previous literature. And I found a paper that had been published a few years before. I looked at the graph and I thought, whatever the paper is trying to say, the correlation that they put in that paper was wrong. And I looked at the data and I thought, there's another way of presenting this data. And so I replotted the data, and I replotted that data against something called the standard electropotential. Basically, looking at it, it was a smooth correlation which indicated that if that was right, gold would be the best catalyst for this reaction. Now, that is totally counterintuitive because everybody knows gold is an extremely noble element. It's used in jewelry because it doesn't corrode. It's used in dental applications because it doesn't react, it doesn't do anything. And bulk gold is unreactive in that way. But when you subdivide it down to small nanoparticles or individual atoms, it becomes incredibly reactive. But that was only known after this type of research was done. And if people said, oh, I'm going to use gold to do something, everybody would have said, well, that's wrong. You can't do it because gold is the most noble of the metals and it won't react. Looking at this correlation, predicting that gold would be the best catalyst, I thought, well, I've got to now convince my management that we're going to have to spend a lot of money to test that result. But they trusted the prediction, and we built a small unit to test it. And indeed, gold is the best catalyst for the reaction. And I was sort of lucky in the sense that I was able to work on this. I was able to do the prediction. I was able to confirm the prediction was right. And then I decided in my career terms that I'd had enough of being in industry. Industry is a great place to be. You're part of a team, and the team is important. But I was working on problems, and you'd only partially solve a problem, and then your management was very happy that you'd got some sort of solution, and they move you on to something else. And I wanted to be in charge of my own destiny, so I decided I wanted to be an academic. And I wanted to be a lecturer, I wanted to go to university and teach, and I wanted to do my own research. And so I then had a lectureship at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, and I continued to work on gold catalysis there and published quite a few papers as a result of that. But the key paper was this prediction. I said to my company that I'd worked for, can I publish this? And large companies don't communicate across them, and this is something which I think many people might appreciate. The person I asked had no idea that the company was trying to commercialize this. And so he said, yes, it was fine to publish it. Whereas had he known, he would have said, no, don't publish this. And I would never have been allowed to tell the story, ever. But he didn't know. And so it was exceptionally lucky on my part that I was able to publish this and then do all the work and get the recognition from having done that work. Now, that's back in the 80s and early 90s. And then it sort of just went away at that point. But in Japan, Masataki Haruta was working on gold as well, and he was doing carbon monoxide oxidation. Now, that's becoming very important in the household these days because, carbon monoxide is a silent killer. If you have a gas fire which is not operating properly, you can kill yourself with carbon monoxide. And so having a catalyst that will take carbon monoxide at room temperature and turn it into carbon dioxide is extremely valuable. And Masataki Haruta worked on this, and he found that gold was the best catalyst for that reaction. So you had these two pieces of work which were showing for the first time that gold was far better than anything else And so this perception of gold being an unreactive, boring element was totally disproved at that point. But it was a slow take-up, I would say, by the whole community, and that these papers were there. CO, the oxidation of carbon dioxide, is much easier to do than acetylene hydrochlorination. So many, many people then worked on the carbon monoxide one. And gold catalysis is now an extremely popular subject in terms of all the reactions that it's capable of doing. So there's a whole new branch of chemistry. But in terms of the vinyl chloride work, everything went quiet until 2007, when one of my first PhD students, Peter Johnston, was working for Johnson Matthey in the UK, and he approached me saying that Johnson Matthey had acquired all of the reports and the rights to the work that we'd done in South Africa as part of AECI. And of course, my reports were in there, and he suggested it would be good if we could do some work together. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. You know, always interested in that sort of thing. Now, the real problem was, how do you make a gold catalyst for an industrial process where you need hundreds of tons of the material? And the catalyst that we'd made in South Africa contained far too much gold and were made using a very strong acid. And so you couldn't actually use that to make tons of catalyst. And Pete came up with an inspired way to make the catalyst using basically a sulfur compound of gold and using a non-acid method. And when this was made, using very, very small amounts of gold, such that the carbon support is far more expensive in terms of the mass of the catalyst than the gold, it worked perfectly. And in commercial tests, it has worked extremely, extremely well. And so now, you know, this gold catalyst is being commercialized in China. And it's been rather special to have been involved right at the start and all the way through. But that's from the outset in 1982 to its initial commercial trials and successful commercial trials in 2015. That's 33 years. That's a long time. It's half a lifetime. No. Or maybe, if we're really lucky, a third of a lifetime. You have to have patience, I'd say, that, you know, and have belief that you really can make a difference in that way. The nice thing about that is that because of the advent of the gold catalyst, China was able to ratify the Minamata Convention. And in May 2017, the 50th country ratified the Minamata Convention, and consequently it became international law, so that mercury will now be not possible to be used in new applications and will be phased out from existing applications. And that will, the timescale for that is around 2022. So this is a lovely example of a piece of science that's sort of driven international law. And I think it's a real privilege to have been part of that and be part of that story, and to remove mercury in this way, because people will still want PVC. And it will be some time before we come up with non-biodegradable polymers, which are not based on sort of petrochemicals. That will happen, and that will be the next phase of work.
Professor Graham Hutchings, Regius Professor of Chemistry and former director of the Cardiff Catalysis Institute, one of the world's leading research facilities for catalysis. Last month, on the 10th anniversary of the CCI, Professor Hutchings stepped down and handed over the reins, but will continue to be a key player in the world of heterogeneous catalysis. I asked Professor Hutchings what advice he would give to those aspiring to be scientists.
My feeling is that it's an absolute privilege to be a scientist. And as to have been a chemist has been fantastic. The things you can react and do, the things you can change is really quite remarkable, I would say. In terms of advice, if you're going to be a scientist, I would say don't in any way be monovision. Always be open to new ideas and new approaches. My PhD training was in biological chemistry. I then joined industry, and they changed me into a physical chemist on day one, because they had recruited me as a biological chemist, but then they decided they didn't want to do that anymore. And this is what industry is like. It's a commercial operation. And so I had to make a decision whether to stay with ICI or leave. And I preferred to have my mortgage paid, so I stayed. And I changed fields dramatically, just like that. And I think you have to have the sort of realize that if you're trained, if you become, you know, just going down a certain pathway, it doesn't mean that's what you have to do for the rest of your life. You can be open to lots and lots of new challenges and new opportunities. And that's something I always say to people. The other thing I would say is science is about ideas. It's about having ideas that you can change something. And there's huge challenges that now need to be addressed. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with global warming, to me, is a huge challenge for the future. And it's made more difficult these days because politically, in certain areas, it's not seen to be a major problem. I would rather err on safety and say that if, you know, the link in some people's minds between CO2, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and global warming is not well made, I'd rather work on the basis that we should do something about it rather than we'll find out in 50 years' time that actually it was right and carbon dioxide was the real problem. And it's inevitable that life, human life, will no longer be possible in a few hundred years' time. That would be a real miss opportunity. And so I would rather we work on that and solve that problem now. The other is access to water is going to be extremely important. In this country, you know, in the UK, we have lots and lots of water because it rains a lot. But that's not true across the world. And so access to clean water is going to be exceptionally important in the future. And so I would say there's lots of challenges there. And, you know, whether you approach it from an engineering point of view, from a physical sciences point of view, from a mathematical point of view, there are opportunities for you all to get involved. And to some extent, I wish I was starting again, because I would then have another 40 years to tackle some of these really important problems. I hope I can make some impact in some of them in the next part of my career, and I certainly aim to. But I think, you know, there's great challenges now, and I think there's fantastic opportunities. Is there?
21 minutes, that's exactly how long
we have to do. Is there?
Yeah.
Can you edit out the ums and things?
No, or not? Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoyed that anyway. I mean, any scientist loves talking about themselves. Come on.
Professor Hutchings showed me his certificate of Regius Professorship, appointed by Her Majesty the Queen.
The original's held by the university.
Professor Hutchings is the first academic to have the title at Cardiff University.
So the university, it can now appoint for all time a Regius Professor. So the title, when I step down, they will appoint somebody else a Regius Professor of Chemistry. So it's chemistry. The oldest one goes back, I think, to 1497. You'll have to check out in literature. But this is the first one in Wales. Wales has not had any. And over 500 years, no. No. So I think you could describe this as quite a rarity.
Wow, that's really amazing.
It is.
The university whole thing.
They've got the original. They wouldn't let me have it. I was given it. I was given the original, you know, and I was, oh, yeah, yeah. And the VC's secretary came up to me, Sunita, straight away and said, that's for us. And I was like, oh. To whom these presents shall come, greetings. Yes. Now know ye that we for divers good causes and considerations. So this is brilliant. Do hereby for ourselves, our heirs and successors, give and grant unto the office or place of Professor of Chemistry in the University of Cardiff a mark of our royal grace and favour. That's really brilliant.
With huge thanks to Professor Graham Hutchings for sharing his story. You can find out more about him, his work and the CCI on the website and on social media. Links are in the show notes. Think Tank is a free and independent production made possible by our loyal patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thinktankpodcast to donate. You can listen to past and future episodes on Apple Podcasts and all other platforms, and we are now on Spotify. Why not consider leaving a rating and a review? And subscribe to get future episodes, including our documentary, straight to your app or streaming service of choice. With sound design by Rowan Lees, music by Azir, I'm Harry Bly. You've been listening to Think Tank.